Welcome to Sport Management Review Insights. I'm your host, Vito Subra. As sport managers and researchers will no doubt understand, sports sponsorship has received a great deal of attention on both this podcast and in the Sport Management Review Journal. In this episode, we're going to focus on sponsorship retention and the factors involved in keeping sponsorships going. Joining us to discuss this is a scholar who's published a great deal on sports sponsorship. He's assistant professor in sport administration at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It's Jonathan Jensen. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you on from the great University of North Carolina as well, which is really exciting. Jonathan and co-authors David Head, Olivia Munro, and Scott Nessler recently published Investigating Sport League Sponsorship Retention, Results from a Semi-Parametric Hazard Model. Jonathan, I think it's safe to say sponsorship really is the lifeblood of sport funding. How did this research help our understanding of sports sponsorship more generally?
Sure, that's a great question. Well, sports sponsorship is still growing despite COVID, where we had a bit of a setback on a variety of things. It's still, as you mentioned, a really important funding mechanism for sport organizations and leagues. It's really second only to media rights. Media rights are really the only source of income for sport organizations that are growing at a greater percentage than sports sponsorship. The specific sponsorships that we looked at in this study, one of the reasons why we wanted to dig into them is they are terribly important for the survival of sport leagues, and they're extremely lucrative. Just one example, here in the U.S., Gatorade sports drink product has been an official status sponsor of the NFL since 1983 and has kept that sponsorship going all that time. And they pay more than $50 million per year for those rights. And just as an example, what that provides to Gatorade is complete category exclusivity, not just at the league level, but for every single NFL team, all 32 teams have Gatorade on the sidelines of their games, and no other types of drinks are allowed on the sidelines. That's just one example of how powerful these sponsorships can be and how lucrative they can be for the league themselves.
And as you mentioned, sponsorship is such an important aspect. So many factors, also ways to look at it. Why was sponsorship retention an important area to look at for researchers?
Sponsorship retention and renewal rates are something that are constantly on the mind of those in the industry. They're talked about ad nauseum in publication, industry publications such as the Sports Business Journal. However, there's just been very little academic research about them. And it's really no mystery why that's the case. We had to spend between 2 and 3 years developing this data set that includes almost 500 different sponsorships across 6 different sports leagues. It was a terribly exhausting effort. I was happy that my students, David Head, who now works for a sports marketing agency called Intersport, and Olivia Munro, who now works for IBM in Washington, D.C., both of them were extremely talented and dedicated students in my sports analytics lab that helped gather this historical data set. So it just takes a lot of time to go back into the archives and dig up the histories of these sponsorships. And then the other thing is you need a really advanced model that is able to handle both sponsorships that have ended previously, but then also sponsorships that are currently ongoing. So you need a very robust statistical methodology. To me, those are really the two reasons why renewal rates in the past have not really been studied extensively in academia. It just requires a lot of work and a very sophisticated modeling technique in order to truly properly analyze them.
Just before we get into the model, I want to ask about the theories you used for this research, because you looked at it through the framework of schema theory, balance theory, congruence theory, and signaling theory. Can you tell us a bit about how all those relate to sports sponsorship retention?
Yeah, well, theory is important, and not just to kind of validate why some results you might be seeing, but also to predict what's going to happen. And just as an example, so schema theory is important for a couple of different things we were looking at in this study, both the negative effects of clutter and then also the negative effects of assigning sponsors a lower level of other sponsors. And the reason is the how schema theory is applied to sponsorship is that psychologists theorize that we have essentially compartments or They'll call them kind of buckets of information inside our brain. And in order to create shortcuts and in order to process all the information that's getting thrown at us on a daily basis, our minds essentially categorize things in different places. And this is why we have things like stereotypes and other things that help folks file information away in their brains. How this has been applied to sponsorship, and I'm not the first person to do that, it's been done in several studies, is that the hope as a sponsor and as a sponsoring brand is that your brand is going to be categorized in the same place in the consumer's brain as the property that they love. For example, if they're a fan of the FIFA World Cup and they know that Coca-Cola is a sponsor of the FIFA World Cup, they know that they, when they go to a World Cup match, they're going to drink Coca-Cola. Perhaps even they've visited the FIFA World Cup trophy tour and seen or touched the actual World Cup trophy, which is sponsored by Coca-Cola. The hope is then that the good feelings that they have about FIFA and about the World Cup then are associated in their brains with the feelings they have about Coca-Cola. And then ultimately, even if they don't recognize it, when they go to make that buying decision in the market and they're choosing between Pepsi and Coca-Cola, they're going to just automatically choose Coca-Cola, not necessarily because of the benefits that the product provides or the taste, but just that they have a positive feeling about that brand because they're stored in the same area of their brain as their love for football. So that's just one example of how schema theory applies. And how we applied it in this study is the thought is that the more clutter you have, so the more different sponsors that in this case a sport league is providing exposure to, the more difficult it's going to be for the consumer to categorize, you know, one particular sponsor, you know, with that league. If you have 30, 40, even 50 different sponsors, it's just going to be very difficult to cut through all of that clutter and recognize the fact that, okay, this sponsor is, you know, a high level sponsor of this league. So I'm going to associate the two because, you know, it's having to share the exposure with 49 other sponsors. So that's one reason why we thought that clutter would be detrimental. And then similarly, the level that if you have one group of sponsors at a higher level and then a greater group of the 30 other sponsors at a lower level, similarly, it's just going to be more difficult for those sponsors to cut through that clutter and get to the end consumer and in the end have that consumer then file that information away in the same place as they do for the love of the sport property.
Now, in terms of the data collection, you said that this was a really painstaking, I guess, at times exercise. How did you go about considering what data are we going to collect? How are we going to collect that?
You know, 20 years ago, it wouldn't have been possible to collect this data because before the internet and before data and information was widely available, you just weren't going to be able to piece it all together. But one of the things that we've found in our field of sport management is it's become a lot easier to go back and reconstruct historical data sets and history because of the internet and databases that are out there. So fortunately for those of us in academia, it's becoming a lot easier to do research with secondary data, which before the internet was, you had to go out and collect your own data. But now entire fields are able to do that. In our case, we're lucky that publications like the Sports Business Journal and IEG, which has been around for about 30 years, kind of collect annual lists of official sponsors across the major leagues. And so we were able to basically just go back, very painstakingly, because we wanted to make sure that our information was accurate, but essentially categorize how long each existing sponsor has been a sponsor, but then perhaps more importantly, look at who was the sponsor in their category before the current sponsor took over and how long that sponsor was around, when the deal started and when it ended, and then any previous sponsors that had, occupied the category. And we were able, again, to collect almost 500 sponsorships dating all the way back to 1954. And there were a couple sponsorships in our data set that actually lasted 50 years, Union 76 with NASCAR that ended in 2003, and Gillette and Major League Baseball that ended in 2008. So it's a robust data set. It's generalizable, I believe, across multitude of different leagues because we looked at six different leagues, but it's also longitudinal, which is important from a research standpoint to try to infer causal inference or suggest that the findings that you have are significant because you're able to look at longitudinal effects over time.
It is extraordinary. And just to reiterate, you mentioned the six leagues there. That was the NFL, MLB, Major League Soccer, NASCAR, NBA, and the NHL. So really impressive data set there. And of course, to analyze this data, you use the proportional hazards model. We've actually spoken about that in another podcast with Matthew Yarovich, which was about NFL head coach race. Please have a listen to that. And you use that here for sponsorship retention. How was the model used in this aspect?
It's a great model. It's typically used in the fields of biostatistics and public health to examine an important consideration of a person's lifetime. You know, what it's used typically in that context is to look at various factors like, say, a cancer diagnosis or, you know, another disease diagnosis or perhaps a transplant, and then look at how that particular event that is occurring in a person's lifetime either then increases or decreases the probability of a specific event occurrence of interest, which in that case is the patient's death. So it's something you want to avoid. Similarly, you know, how we're applying it, Salaga and Jervich looked at it as it relates to a coach's tenure, and they found that race was not a significant predictor of the length of a NFL head coach's time frame. We were looking at it at the lifetime of the sponsorship, and similarly, trying to isolate an event occurrence of interest, which was also an event that everyone's trying to avoid, which is the end of the sponsorship, which both from a brand perspective, the sponsoring firm, if a sponsorship ends, that means that they've provided a great deal of resources and obviously it just hasn't worked. You know, we're kind of looking at it as a renewal of a sponsorship as a proxy for positive sponsorship return on investment, because in today's world of decreasing resources, we wouldn't continue to invest in sponsorships if they weren't working. And then obviously from the property side, they're losing a great deal of revenue, and it's much easier to keep an existing sponsor than to go out and get a new one. From all sides, this is an event that you want to avoid. What this model does is essentially not just measure and properly measure the length of time up until this event happens, and also it's able to isolate the effects of various types of covariates on, you know, the probability of this event occurrence of interest occurring. And it's able to handle both time invariant variables, meaning, you know, designations that might not change over time, but then also continuous variables that may change, you know, year over year. It's a very robust model. Once you understand how it works conceptually, it's not terribly difficult to implement. And we're seeing it much more in the sport management side of things, where it's being applied to look at the durations of a great deal of different, you know, tenures of time, such as the amount of time that a donor is with an organization, the amount of time an executive, like an athletic director, is at a particular university, and then we're applying it to look at the timeline of sponsorships.
So using this model based on the analysis, what were the key findings from this study?
Well, we were able to look at a great deal of different things, you know, just from what we like to call the descriptive statistics of survival analysis and hazard models. We were able to compute both the probability of a sponsorship ending in any given year, which across all the leagues was 7.34%, which equates to a renewal rate of 92.7%, which is helpful. And then also we're able to compute what we call a median lifetime of that sponsorship. And again, the reason why we feel like this is more effective is that this median lifetime is the point at which half of all of these sponsorships have ended and half are still continuing. So this median lifetime is able to take into account, you know, both of those situations, and the median lifetime that we computed was 8.3 years. So it allows both the sponsors and the sport organizations to kind of plan ahead and just understand generally how long these sponsorships last. And then we obviously were able to break it down on a league by league basis because we had six different leagues. And what was interesting to me is the renewal rates were very similar. They ranged from 91.1% for Major League Baseball and 94.2% for for the NFL. So on an annual basis, the renewal rates were quite similar. That's one other reason why I feel like this research is and these results are fairly generalizable, because we did find similar results across the leagues. However, when we computed the median lifetimes for the sponsorships, we got very different results. One of the findings is this really quantifies the dominance of the National Football League in the U.S. market. It's the most popular sports league, and its median lifetime correspondingly was 11.4 years. So a long amount of time, and longer than the average median lifetime across all the leagues. However, Major League Baseball, and kind of a signal to their kind of waning popularity across the U.S. when, you know, in the 70s and 80s, they were the dominant sport league, their median lifetime was just over 5 years. So when you think about it, you know, most of these sponsorships are, you know, $6 to $10 million outlays on an annual basis. To have a median lifetime of one league sponsorship at 5 years, another over 11, is a significant difference. I think we did not think that the results would vary that much across the leagues.
Just from a theoretical perspective and advancing our understanding, what does this all mean? How does this advance the theory?
Well, you know, getting back to some of the theories we talked about, like schema theory and balance theory, we also, the second part of the research is we were able to apply various theories to understand how specific types of variables then influence that length of tenure, whether it increases the tenure or decreases, or more specifically, increases the probability that a sponsor will exit or decrease it. And to me, I think a couple of the most interesting results there was the impact of clutter. As we talked about, you know, we theorized that more sponsors, more clutter would increase the probability that sponsors would exit, which is something that has been, you know, written about a lot, but we were actually able to quantify what that probability was. And what we found was that, so every additional sponsor that the league adds to their portfolio increases the probability that each and every sponsor will exit in every given year by 3.3%. To me, that provides a measure of pause for those at the league level. They understand, okay, adding a sponsor does add revenue. However, that need for an increased revenue needs to be balanced with the fact that it makes it more difficult for all the other sponsors to stand out. So they need to think about that, you know, when they're, you know, adding sponsors to their portfolio. And similarly, sponsors at a lower level were 79.8% more likely to exit. And what happens in a lot of leagues like the NHL is they'll limit their activation potential. They'll say, okay, well, this group of sponsors can only activate in Canada. This group of sponsors can only activate in the US. And what we found is that providing those limitations around a sponsor then makes it more difficult for those sponsors then to leverage the sponsorship and ultimately receive a positive return on investment from the sponsor, because those sponsors at a lower level were significantly more likely to exit the sponsorship. And then one more traditional kind of fairly unsurprising result was the importance of congruence. Congruence is quite possibly the most studied construct in the sponsorship literature, and we found its effect were important here. Congruent sponsors were 70.8% less likely to exit than sponsors that are not congruent. And that makes sense, particularly with this context, because as in the Gatorade example that I mentioned earlier, in these sponsorships, a lot of times the official products are getting integration into the event itself, whether it's the balls that they play with or being able to leverage and activate the product on the sidelines with the athletes. But it makes sense that better fitting products and sponsor categories are going to do better with these sponsorships and then ultimately stay with them longer.
Now, just from a practical sense, Jonathan, I think so many sport organizations and sports sponsors and potential sponsors want to hear from you is, what advice would you give them when they're dealing with sponsors and when sponsees are dealing with teams? What advice would you give them when we're considering and sponsorship managers are considering all these factors?
Yeah, great question. I think in a lot of respects, you know, people focus so much on the money and how much a sponsor is paying, and they want to get those big dollar and big ticket sponsors. But when you think about it, you know, sponsor retention and being able to keep a sponsor for not just, you know, 1 3-year contract, but multiple years and on to multiple decades is really going to influence both organizations positively in the long run. So my recommendation would be for sport organizations to not just think about bagging that big ticket sponsor for a 1 3-year period at the highest amount that they could potentially spend, but think about targeting sponsors that exhibit these characteristics that would suggest that they would be long-term partners. We've done some research in sponsorship that basically found that in an ideal world, sponsorship is an exchange of resources from both sides. It's not just a sponsor paying money to help support the sport organization, but ideally it's basically a cycle that goes through both organizations. We've looked at this in the context of Formula One, and ideally the sponsor is not only paying money, but also providing expertise and resources to the organization, and then both organizations are benefiting. But in many respects, a lot of times organizations and executives within those organizations are just thinking about, hey, let's just get the sponsor and then we're done. I would suggest that they take a more long-term view and target sponsors that are congruent, that have a B2B aspect to their sponsorship in which they're able to provide some value in kind product. And our research shows that that's going to lead to a more longer term partnership. And then also provide those sponsors, instead of limiting their activation potential and putting them on a lower level. And what happens a lot of times is they say, well, you can't pay what we want you to pay, so we're going to essentially relegate you to a lower level. Take a more open mind and realize, what they're paying at the initial amount could actually grow in the future as, you work together, and do not relegate them to a lower level, because our research shows that that will simply lead to a sponsorship ending fairly quickly. But if they're able to resist the temptation to do that and take a more long-term view of it, then they're going to end up with a sponsor that's going to stay with them much, much longer. And then it may benefit the property or the sport organization, not just monetarily, but also in this kind of theoretical exchange of resources over a long-term basis. And then in the end, everybody wins.
It sounds like really important, useful advice. I wish I had that advice when I was working at a sport club myself, but a bit late for that now. That's still really interesting research, really fascinating chat, Jonathan. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate you having us.
And thanks for listening to Sport Management Review Insights. At the Sport Management Review website, you'll find all the latest research being published, including the article discussed in this episode, Investigating Sport League Sponsor Retention Results from a Semi-Parametric Hazard Model. That's it for this episode, but take a look. There's plenty more you can download to your favorite podcast player. Until then, it's bye for now.